Amen. Thank you. Hey, I'm Melissa C. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I live in New York and really happy to be here tonight. Happy to see all of you. I want to add my welcome to Janet's welcome. The chapter we're going to discuss tonight is A Vision for You. So if you get out your big book, we'll jump right in. Lot to go over tonight. We'll start with page 151. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends, and a feeling that life is good, but not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but distant memories, and never could we recapture the great moments of the past. So, what I get from that paragraph, it starts off right away for most normal for folks. Well, first of all, by the time we get to this chapter, we should be pretty clear that we're not normal. Like, I'm not normal. I am, I am what we term as a distinct entity. I am different from normal people. So normal people, by the way, they don't just eat for nutrition, right? It says it here. They eat for fun. They eat for intimacy. They eat for reasons, for release from boredom, for worry and care. Normal folks also eat when they're restless, irritable, and discontent. The fact that I have turned to food when I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, that's not the distinguishing factor that makes me a compulsive overeater. Lots of people, normal people, turn to food for lots of reasons that are not nutrition. Historically, right? Like, you break up with a boyfriend, what do? You go get ice cream, right? Even people would, have a breakup and they'd go out and get drunk. I mean, these were kind of like, doesn't necessarily make someone a compulsive eater or an alcoholic if they respond to stressful situations or joyous situations by using alcohol and food. The difference is that part of my step one understanding is I can no longer treat food like normal people do. It can't be an event for me. I can't engage in recreational eating, yet I can go wherever normal people go, right? And if you remember when we studied the chapter Working with Others, it tells us this on page 101 that, our rule is to, you don't have to avoid a place where they're drinking if you have a legitimate reason for being there. And then it talks about an important qualification, right? This is all in working with others. And so, but what's different about us, right? What's different about me at social gatherings? Normal people can hang around the dinner table for a long time and they can enjoy casual eating. They can eat spontaneously at a cocktail party, and happy hours and other ways that normal people socialize with food, almost as if it were the background music, right? They're at an event and the food is the background music for them. They have a few bites and they can still hear the conversation around them. They eat to enhance the gathering. But when I engage in casual eating, what would happen for me is that background music of the food gets so loud that it is the only thing that can be heard. No one around me. I can't attend to the conversations of the people around me. All I would hear is the chatter in my brain about the food, right? And it would sound like this: should I? Shouldn't I? Am I eating too much? Does anybody notice? I shouldn't eat anymore. I won't eat this in front of others. So that I'm not engaging at all socially anymore, right? I have completely isolated right in the middle of a crowd once I started eating food the way that normal people were. And yes, it was then a sad realization for me that eating, socially, spontaneous eating dinners out and ice cream from the neighborhood ice cream stand, like all these things that it seemed relatively normal that I could no longer do. And it wasn't because some sponsor told me I couldn't, but because I had conceded to my innermost self that there was nothing social anymore about my eating. The disease, though, tried to convince me by appealing to my sense of nostalgia, right? It would get all nostalgic with me about food that, and it would prey on that human desire to connect. So it would, try to convince me that this is how I can connect to my culture, or it was how I could connect with my family, or how I could, kind of participate with my friends. But my recovery informed me that I cannot eat to socialize. For me, eating was antisocial. I can't use food for connection and intimacy. I actually disconnect and I can't feel close with the people near me. In fact, I have a memory about going out to dinner with a very close friend who was experiencing the breakup of her marriage. And we went out to dinner together and I vaguely recall her crying. But the truth is, there was a bread basket on the table and I took a piece of bread. And I think I heard every third word she said, because all I heard in my brain was, can I get away with more bread? Can I eat more? I don't even think she's noticing. It's okay. I can keep eating bread. And then I also remember having this thought went off in my brain, which is a horrible thought, but there was a piece of me that said, ooh, she's so upset. I bet she's going to want dessert. That's where my brain went when I, and so when food is your master, you don't care about your friend's crumbling marriage because food demands all your attention. And so if that's the case for someone like me, this chapter starts off with saying, then how am I going to connect? What's going to become of me? And I think the chapter could also be called, now what am I supposed to do? Like, now what? Right? In page 152, paragraph one, yes, I'm willing, but am I consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? So the truth is, I did one time think that life without food and with alcohol was going to be dull. I thought I would be stupid and boring and glum without my stuff, and I was worried, how am I going to fit in? For me at the time, it was like with all the other cool neighborhood moms that were drinking wine and eating salsa and chips, like, where am I going to hang out? Who's going to want to hang out with me? And I felt afraid of living without the food because I didn't have a sufficient substitute, but I was willing to do anything to get released for me from bleeding gums, because I ate till my gums bled, and an obese body. And I worked the steps and I found there is a substitute. And it's even better than a substitute. And really, what happens is we call it a spiritual awakening, and it is much better than the food. Only an addict really in the throes of the food believes that they're more exciting when they're eating, right? How exciting was life when I was laying on the couch, looking out the window at everybody enjoying life? Or when I was sitting in my car eating alone? Like, what's going to become of my substitute? Will I get a substitute, or will there forever be an empty hole? Page 152, the second paragraph. Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous, for me in Overeaters Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Life will mean something at last. So we absolutely get a substitute, but actually something much greater than a substitute, vastly more, right? And a substitute is just something that serves in place of another. It's something that replaces another, you know? And so, you know, and one of the things like I looked up substitute, and, you know, in psychology, which this isn't a psychological program, but here's, you know, here's a term. A substitute is a person or thing that becomes the object of love when we're deprived of our natural outlet. And so, food, right? When I'm deprived of my natural outlet. So, what is my natural outlet? Well, it's a relationship with God. You know, food was my substitute for a much more meaningful relationship. And, you know, and so what I get now is I get a fellowship where I can feel the love of God through humans, from humans, and I can give it to humans, the love of God with and among us. You know, and so what we get is a life that means something, a true purpose and a mission, right? A mission. You know, when I first came to OA, it was not because I was bored or worried or lacked imagination. I didn't think my life was lacking meaning or purpose. I didn't think I had an unmanageable problem. I actually came at first for this for simple reasons, like most people. I didn't like what I weighed and I was unhappy about it. And I couldn't seem to do anything about it. You know, and I knew I needed to do something, and yet I couldn't do the thing that I knew I needed to do. And I knew that food was causing me so much misery. I knew inside that certain foods did something to me that it didn't seem to do to other people. And I thought that if OA could give me more willpower and help me shed that extra weight, then I would be fine. I didn't think I was living an unsatisfactory life. Didn't think that was my problem. And I do remember putting the food down and feeling lonely and unsure. How was I going to go away on vacation? Right? How am I going to take, you know, at the time it was family camping trips. You know, was I even going to enjoy these events if I couldn't eat my way through them? And I discovered actually that life was more enjoyable when food was not calling the shots. When food was not my master, I actually began to enjoy life on a whole new level because I found out who I was going to be. I found out that I was going to be useful and I was going to give rather than take. I was going to share the recovery that I found. Page 153, paragraph one. How can they rise out of such misery, bad repute, and hopelessness? And the practical answer is that since these things have happened among us, they can happen with you. Should you wish them above all else and be willing to make use of our experience, we are sure they will come. The age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. Yes, the age of miracles is still with us. In fact, that is what this entire program is about. This is a program for people who must have a miracle. And so we know that the age of miracles is still among us. And I know that I'm a walking, breathing miracle. I am like in the flesh, a miracle right here and now. And I feel this deep down in my heart, you know, and it's available for anyone. But there's two conditions, they said. One, you must wish them above all else, meaning you have to want this and put this in the front of your life. For me, I could not fit recovery into my life. That was not how it was going to work. I actually had to build my life around my recovery. I had to want this way of life more than I wanted a number on the scale. I had to put that aside and stop focusing so much on what I wanted away. And I had to want it, obviously, more than a piece of candy, right? I mean, I was powerless over the candy, but I had to want this more. I had to want it more than fitting in with my colleagues. I had to want it more than I wanted a good reputation. I had to want it more than a lot of things. I had to want it more than feeling comfortable hanging out with women, drinking wine, and eating chips. This had to become more important to me. You know, And so you have to make use of the examples of others. So you have to want it above all else, and then you have to be willing to make use of the examples of others. And what are the others that you're supposed to make use of? They're examples, those that have had a deep and effective spiritual experience, right? Those are the people who you ought, right, to look at for directions and examples. You know, and I'd say this is why we don't water down our course of action, because I cannot make the directions easy and cut corners. You know, I am not to be concerned with frightening someone off from recovery. That's the job of the disease. The disease is scary enough. The solution is what the solution is, right? This recovery that I've been given, freedom from the food and from my broken thinking. For me, I've been relieved of obesity. I've let go of more than 160 pounds, and I have lived in a healthy body with a healthy mind for years now. And, you know, if a friend calls me to talk about an issue, if they're upset about something, I can hear them. I can hear what they're saying to me. By the way, even if there's bread on the table, right? There could be a bakery sitting on the table. I can still hear my friends that are right next to me. Food does not own me. I can go on any vacation with anybody. You know, I go all over the place. I've experienced the miracle, right? And a miracle is an act of God, right? That's what a miracle is. And that's what this is all about. That the 12 steps are a set of directions, right? We like to say it's a recipe for cooking up a miracle. And it's an invitation. I say the 12 steps for me were an invitation for God to enter my life and change me entirely. It's a complete willingness to transform. And I've witnessed this in my own life and in the lives of so many others. It's unbelievable how many others have experienced the same thing. And so, in fact, helping others to experience this miracle is now our mission. That's what we do now. You know, a vision for you is a direction for how to live now, which is we live the rest of our lives helping others to get well, right? The bottom of page 153 to the bottom to page 154 that I wrote in here. Read this, and I'm wondering if somebody would be willing to have their book in front of them. Anybody want to read from the bottom of page 153 to the top
I
of
can.
who was I can? Go ahead,
Genoa.
Noah, go for it.
Okay. Years ago in 1935, one of our number made a journey to a certain Western city. From a business standpoint, his trip came off badly. Had he been successful in his enterprise, he would have been set on his feet financially, which at the time seemed vitally important. But his venture wound up in a lawsuit and bogged down completely. The proceeding was shot through with much hard feeling and controversy. Keep going. Bitterly discouraged. Okay.
Read that.
Bitterly discouraged, he found himself. Oh, good. Okay. I'll keep
Read
going.
the
Okay.
next
Bitterly
paragraph.
discouraged, he found himself. He found himself in a strange place, discredited and almost broke. Still physically weak and sober but a few months, he saw that his predicament was dangerous. He wanted so much to talk with someone, but whom? One dismal afternoon, he paced a hotel lobby, wondering how his bill was to be paid. At one end of the room stood a glass-covered directory of local churches. Down the lobby, a door opened into an attractive bar. He could see the gay crowd inside. In there, he would find companionship and release. Unless he took some drinks, he might not have the courage to scrape an acquaintance and would have a lonely weekend. Of course, he couldn't drink, but why not sit hopefully at a table, a bottle of ginger ale before him? After all, had he not been sober 6 months now? Perhaps he could handle, say, three drinks, no more. Fear gripped him. He was on thin ice. Again, it was the old insidious insanity, that first drink. With a shiver, he turned away and walked down the lobby to the church directory. Music and gay chatter still floated to him from the bar. But what about his responsibilities, his family, and the men who would die because they would not know how to get well? Yes, those other alcoholics. There must be many such in this town. He would phone a clergyman. His sanity returned and he thanked God. Selecting a church at random from the directory, he stepped into a booth and lifted the receiver.
Awesome.
His
And so that's what it means to have our sanity return. He was tempted, and what happened was he recoiled. It is sane to recoil. That's the sane response. You know, the sanest thing that we can do when life is getting us worked up, when problems knock on the door, we go find someone to help. And this story is a sharp contrast from Fred on page 54, who had his business dealings go well, right? There's Fred. His business dealings went well. And what's the difference between the two of them? The spiritual experience was the difference. Because what happened with Fred, he crossed the threshold of the dining room. The thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. I ordered a cocktail and my meal. And we all know that didn't go so well for Fred, right? Thank you, Genoa. I appreciate your reading it. But Bill, the difference was he remained sober. And it actually turned out to be a wonderful thing that his business dealings didn't go so well that day. Because in his despair, he reached out and wound up as a result meeting Dr. Bob. And to me, this is evidence that I don't really know what's best for me, do I? Right? That in fact, I found out for me, my experience was the thing that brought me here, that like really sent me to my knees, was extreme panic attacks that I suffered at like the worst of this disease. And that was the bottom, and that bottom was a gift. That bottom was a beautiful gift because it forced me to finally admit that I was in trouble. It was a gift. And actually, would you believe another gift that I'd been given was morbid obesity? That was a gift because if not for the pain of obesity, I don't know that I would have been open to forming a relationship with God. I don't know that I would have had another vehicle. And so for me, being 160 pounds overweight was the most incredible gift I could have been given. And I think in this case, you know, Bill's business dealings falling apart was a beautiful gift. In fact, all his dreams came true. Here was a man who just wanted to be well known, who wanted to be somebody at last. And he actually got it, right? In the midst of his ruin, he actually got it. Page 155 describes Bob's predicament now. Formerly able and respected, was then nearing the nadir, which is the lowest point of alcoholic despair. It was the usual situation: home in jeopardy, wife ill, children distracted, bills in arrears, standing damaged. He had a desperate desire to stop, but saw no way out, for he had earnestly tried many avenues of escape. Painfully aware of being somehow abnormal, the man did not fully realize what it meant to be alcoholic. And this to me describes powerlessness and unmanageability. You can have all the painful consequences and a strong desire to stop. That was him, and yet still be unable, right? The next paragraph, Dr. Bob agrees that no amount of willpower he might muster could stop his drinking for long. Because for us, willpower has an expiration date. And, you know, what's the worst part about this expiration date of my willpower is that it's unpredictable, right? It's not stamped on the carton like the milk. I don't know when it runs out. It's the power source that just when I needed it most, it was nowhere to be found, right? A spiritual experience was absolutely necessary, but it felt like the price was too high. The things he had to do that to get that spiritual experience, he was afraid. He was afraid of losing his reputation. And I think, it's important. Let's talk about reputation for a moment. Because reputation are the beliefs or opinions that are generally held about someone or something. And a reputation is widespread belief that someone or something has a particular habit or a particular characteristic. And so Dr. Bob was more concerned with other people's inaccurate beliefs and opinions about him. He wanted others to believe that he had honorable characteristics, yet he knew in his heart he didn't actually have them, right? He was afraid because he was performing surgery and he was drunk. He didn't want people to know that he had been drinking. He was a slave to others' opinions. And, we learn that it's not what others think of us. It's not what others think of me. That's as important as having my integrity. My integrity is more important than my reputation. In my own experience, I've been overly concerned with others' opinions of me. I've said that I was the president of the Melissa C. Public Relations Department. It was my job to sell you my product. And I would do it at any cost. And I, never mind that the business was failing, the business of me was failing. So long as you wanted to buy my product, so long as you thought I was okay, then I was okay. The problem with having your reputation being your God, here's the main problem with your reputation being your God. Well, besides the fact that it's a false God, right? It's an idol, it's not a real God. And it offers you no power. The other problem is that it's a moving target because it's going to depend constantly on who I'm with. It means I'm going to have to change who I'm with for the people I'm with all the time. Because in order for me to have a reputation with certain people, I'm going to have to act a certain way in their company. And if I'm going to have a certain reputation with other people, I'm going to have to be a certain way in other people's company. And so, never being who you really are, or even more importantly, who God designed you to be, because you're overly concerned with reforming yourself so that other people say that you're okay, right? And what are my characteristics when other people arrive on the scene? Well, I don't know, right? I'll never know who I am if I'm constantly changing it to satisfy other people. So, we know Dr. Bob drank again and he stopped though after, right? He saw that he would have to face his problems squarely, that God might give him mastery. So, we don't master our food addiction. God gives us mastery, right? God gives us mastery, God's grace. But first, we have to trust God in cleaning us. Dr. Bob and Bill went on helping others. That's our vision. On page 157, here's an example. It says, put him in a private room, we'll be down. 2 days later, a future fellow of Alcoholics Anonymous stared glassily at the strangers beside his bed. Who are you, fellows, and why this private room? I was always on a ward before, said one of the visitors. We are giving you a treatment for alcoholism. Hopelessness was written large on this man's face as he replied, oh, but that's no use. Nothing would fix me. I'm a goner. The last three times I got drunk on the way home from here, I'm afraid to go out the door. I can't understand. One of the important things that I get from this reading is how they treated this man. They took care of him. They put him in a private room. Remember in the chapter Working with Others, we're told to be patient with people and remember that they are ill. So they didn't send him off to sober him up on his own. And I think we need to remember that when struggling people reach out to us. We help them. And they talk to him. He was not cheered up, though. They were very careful about what they said to him. Rather, they told him over and over about the problem. We don't tell people that they're going to be all right. Like, oh, yay, you're here. Now you're better. Now you're going to get better. Because that would be like going to the doctor, finding out you're sick. You know, for me, I used to get strep throat, right, all the time. So you go to the doctor, they swab your throat. You have strep throat. Oh, okay, now I'm better. Right? That's like the same kind of crazy things that would happen at, for me, at OA meetings. Oh, we're so glad you're here. It's going to get better, honey. Well, that's not true. If you're the hopeless variety, if you don't follow these steps, you're not going to get better, right? You're going to get worse. So we don't tell people that they're going to be all right. Directions for how we carry the message is clear. We emphasize the hopelessness and the mental twist. This is where people begin to identify. They hear themselves in the stories of torment. He identified and says, yes, that's me, the very image. You fellows know your stuff all right, but I don't see what good it'll do. You fellows are somebody. I was once, but I'm a nobody now. And from what you tell me, I know more than ever that I can't stop. And at this point, what do the visitors do? They burst into laughter, right? And that man in the bed said, damn little laugh about that I can see. And I think, like, why were they laughing? And I believe partly because, well, one, because this guy is seeing them as somebodies now. They're probably laughing at like the irony of that. Like now they're somebodies. But I think also that there's happiness inside them because he's taken step one. Admitting powerlessness is a starting point. And until that, nothing can happen. And I know that I'm always really happy when I meet somebody and I can hear that they're done, that they're out of ideas. It's a beautiful starting spot, you know? And so within a few days, right, he went from this. I prayed to God on hangover mornings and sworn I'd never touch another drop, but by 9 o'clock, I'd been boiled as an owl, right? And then the next day found the prospect more receptive. He'd been thinking it over. You know, maybe you're right, he said. God ought to be able to do anything. And then he added, he sure didn't do much for me when I was trying to fix this booze racket alone. And then on the third day, this lawyer gave his life to the care and direction of his creator and said he was perfectly willing to do anything necessary. So he went quickly. From step one to two to three. And we're told that he never drank again. You know, there's a line in there where he said, you know, God ought to be able to do anything. And then he said, he sure didn't do much for me when I was trying to fix this racket alone. And I think, yeah, I never got anywhere when I was trying to do this alone. This is not an independent study. This is a course of treatment that absolutely requires God, and it also requires human support and help. Page 161, paragraph two, being wrecked in the same vessel, being restored and united under one God with hearts and minds attuned to the welfare of others. The things which matter so much to some people no longer signify much to them. How could they? You know, for me, this paragraph clearly defines what it means to have a spiritual awakening. That the things that used to interest me, the things that used to fulfill me and make me excited, they're not the same anymore, you know? And it's something that I'd say sets me apart from other people as well. You know, yes. Normal people can eat socially, but normal people don't have to help others to survive. They might like to or might not, but for me, I require being helpful in order for me to live. My very life depends on my constant thinking of others. And how I can help meet their needs. right? Very different from other people. You know, the other thing I want to say is that not only is it something I have to do to survive, it gives me the greatest joy. There is nothing better. You know, at one time, helping others was something I did because I thought I knew I had to. And then God is so good that He takes the thing that you have to do and He turns it into the thing that you long to do. And that has not just been my experience, but I have seen it. When people have a spiritual awakening, the most exciting thing that happens, you can almost predict it because it's like right on time. They get to the 12th step and they start telling me the people that they've been speaking to that they're like, I think I can help her. You know, this person keeps reaching out. When do you think I'm going to be ready? Because I know this other person who needs help, and you can see that it's organic. It's happened because our roots are grasping new soil. We're told that early on as well, that that's part of it. We become new people. The things that give us support, structure, nourishment, joy are different. We long to be helpful. And so, you know, no, I don't eat socially, right? Doesn't mean I never go out to dinner, but my form of social engagement, the way that I love and connect with people, is not over. I don't need to eat what they're eating to feel close with them, right? I feel close to people when I'm out there helping them, when I'm in there doing the work with others. And you know, today that's the greatest gift I could have ever received. I might not be able to draw nearer to people by breaking bread together, but I absolutely am closer to people than I've ever been in my life. And it extends beyond this fellowship. You know, I feel it with people outside of here. Page 162, now, third paragraph. Thus we grow, and so can you. Though you be but one man with this book in your hand, we believe and hope it contains all you will need to begin. We know what you're thinking. You're saying to yourself, I'm jittery and alone. I couldn't do that, but you can. You forget that you have just now tapped a power source much greater, a source of power much greater than yourself. To duplicate with such backing what we have accomplished is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor. So you're jittery, you're nervous, you're unable to relax. You know, and when I'm jittery, it's because I'm consumed with the future and with myself. Feeling jittery and alone, isolated in his sobriety. And I felt this way at times, both in the food and out of the food. But if I live in agreement with my primary purpose, which is to carry the message to the still sick and suffering, then I don't need to feel jittery and alone, right? And if you remember, it's we tap into a power source. We're not the source of power. We're merely transmitting the power that flows freely from the source through us and out again. You know, and so when I'm afraid, I need only to turn for me towards my creator and I'm comforted. I have all the strength I need. Page 164. Still, you may say, but I will not have the benefit of contact with you who will write this book. We cannot be so sure. God will determine that. So you must remember that your real reliance is always upon him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. They love this. You know, for me, God determines who comes in my life and who leaves my life. And ultimately, though, my reliance is always on God because people are people, right? I need fellowship. God provides me with the fellowship that I crave. And I found that no matter what problems I've experienced, God always puts people in my life who help me through these hard times. God also provides me with the people who I can pass my experiences on to. And how has this happened? Through willingness, patience and labor. You know, willing to be honest, not worshiping reputation or public approval, honest about my past and my present, patient, which means developing, you know, the ability to develop some tolerance towards the discomfort I feel when I wait. It's just delaying gratification and allowing life to unfold rather than trying to force outcomes and labor, right? This program is work. It is work. Working with others, working by giving service, but the work becomes irresistible, truly irresistible. Page 164, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who's still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. So when we say, like, you have every right to find a sponsor, to interview people, you're going to want to find someone who has a relationship with God, because that's what they have to pass on to you. So see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. So God will reveal what I need to see and what path is to be if I ask him, which means if I pray. And if I pray and ask him how I can help others, which is step 11. If I stay close to God, I am promised great events. I abandon myself to God, meaning I give myself. I offer myself. That's step 3. I admit my faults. I clear away my wreckage. That's 4 through 10. And I give freely, steps 12. This is the path so I can trudge the road of happy destiny. The word trudging means it's deliberate, it's slow, it's steady. It's not skipping and dancing, right? Every day is not a skip and a dance. It's not a sprint though. And when I read that, it lets me know that I can live happily through hard times as well. And that is my experience. I've continued to live a full life in recovery through loss, through trials, through uncertainty and pain. But the beautiful is, I no longer suffer. I live with joy and happiness. And that is our vision for everybody. And with that, I'll pass.